Welcome back to another episode of Peace of Earth. This is your host, Akil Cole. In this fourth and final episode of this podcast mini-series, I'll be comparing and contrasting the two cases from episode 2 and 3, the Community Ecology Institute in Columbia, Maryland, and Soil for Life in Cape Town, South Africa. I'll be answering,
how are these cases similar?
How are these cases different?
And what lessons from these cases can we apply elsewhere?
I'll also touch on some limitations to my research and findings, lessons I've learned in my research and creative processes, and hopes for future projects. So, without further ado, enjoy the episode. I know it's been a little minute since I said it outright, but do you remember my research question?
I think so. Wasn't it, how do environmental justice and food organizations use farming and land-based initiatives
to pursue community transformation away from oppressive systems and toward community resistance to said systems? Yeah, that's it. My long-windedness never ceases to amaze me. But that aside, we now have some answers to that question. Let's take a look at those answers, starting with similarities between the Community Ecology Institute and Soil for Life. Firstly, the main bases of operation for these organizations act as well-resourced community centers and third places. At SFL's Home Garden and Training Center in Constantia, as well as CEI's Shreetown Farm and Green Pharmacy Garden, people from all walks of life can meet new folks, develop various skills, teach other people, connect to nature, and experience the missions of each organization in action. Both CEI's Freetown Farm and SFL's home office are sites for the exchange of organic gardening goods, including but not limited to chemical-free seeds, seedlings, and plants, and in the case of Soil for Life, people can also purchase compost and planter boxes. Additionally, these sites are positive places to socialize outside of home and work, or even school, if you're a student like me. Consequently, these gardens and farms fill the much-needed role of a third place for their respective communities.
What's a third place, and what's so important about them?
I remember Akil telling me that third place is a term coined by sociologist Ray Oldenburg that describes locations outside the home and work and school where people spend time together that have a variety of social, civil, and cultural benefits. Think spots like coffee shops, parks, bars, and, in our case, farms and gardens.
Exactly. Unfortunately, we're living at a time when social isolation is an epidemic, and we're substituting meaningful in-person connection for more time in virtual spaces. Both of these have increasingly dire effects on our society's mental and emotional health, including increased rates of anxiety, depression, and other mental illnesses. As a result, the time folks spend at a Soil for Life gardening workshop or at a Freetown Farm plant sale, for instance, is so precious for personal well-being and community building. In addition to the third places, having a lively and well-resourced base of operations has helped both organizations demonstrate the environmental and agricultural principles they hope their communities will adopt. Now, let's look at another important similarity between these two cases. As I reviewed my notes and the stories of the two organizations, I realized that the trajectories of their respective founders were pretty alike. Since she was young, CEI's founder, Dr. Kiara Diamore, has always played outside, and for a brief period of time, she and her family lived on a hobby farm. This inspired her dream of becoming a small-scale farmer. And before CEI, she earned her PhD in sustainability education. Her doctoral work gave rise to Columbia Families in Nature, now called a Community of Families in Nature, or CEFIN, which grew into the Community Ecology Institute in 2016. Ultimately, CEI's mission to cultivate communities where people and nature thrive together has been Dr. Diamore's life's work. In a very comparable way, SFL's founder, the late Pat Featherstone, spent much of her childhood immersed in nature, climbing trees and playing in mud. She attributed her love for gardening to her mother and grandmother, who were avid gardeners. She worked as a school teacher for several years before leaving that setting to set up a food garden at a school in Constantia, the southern Cape Town suburb where SFL's home office is located. Eventually, she taught people how to grow their own food at the Food for Gardens Foundation. And after leaving that organization, she founded Soil for Life in 2002 to teach people how to grow their own food, improve their health and well-being, and nurture and protect the environment. For both Dr. Diamore and Pat Featherstone, their childhoods out in nature, professional experiences,
as educators and powerful personal ethos regarding the environment extended beyond their individual lives and took root in the organizations they founded. If I'm being honest, I just found it so moving that these two women, living and working and teaching in two totally different continents, each created such impactful environmental organizations that serve both people and nature.
That goes to show you how essential good leadership is.
Yeah, both CEI and SFL have very solid roots because of these incredible women.
Well, it also goes to show how instrumental a healthy connection to nature in one person can facilitate healthy human relationships for other people. In fact, that leads me to my third observed similarity between these two cases. Both of these organizations contribute to positive peace in their respective communities. Think back to episode 1, when we discussed the triangle of violence, negative peace, and positive peace. To relate things back to my research question, I see an oppressive system as one that upholds structural violence. Also, an oppressive system uses cultural violence to justify its violent mechanisms. For instance, apartheid in South Africa and Jim Crow laws in the United States were oppressive systems that used legal, economic, and political institutions to structurally limit or, in many cases, destroy the lives of non-white people. In both cases, the violent cultural ideas of white supremacy were used to justify violent structures. Through these organizations, residents of Columbia, Maryland, and Cape Town, South Africa, received services, materials, and experiences that helped them resist the oppressive systems they may face on a day-to-day basis. In the Cape Flats, where the legacies of apartheid have left thousands of Black and colored South Africans facing food insecurity and financial hardship, Soil for Life has trained thousands of people, especially women, how to grow their own food. The Home Food Garden Training Program and community gardening projects have empowered people to supplement their diets with fresh vegetables and to supplement household income from produce sales. In doing this, SFL advances positive peace in Cape Town by boosting resilience against hardship, making sustainable investments in community, and encouraging cooperation between households. Similarly, the Community Ecology Institute has grown and donated thousands of pounds of organic vegetables each year to food insecure residents, including those at a nearby crisis intervention center. Despite the general affluence of Columbia, Maryland, many of its low-income residents fall through the cracks of county, state, and federal support due to language, transportation, or immigration status barriers. CEI's ability to partner with other local nonprofits, as well as to secure funding from donors, foundations, and governments, helps direct resources to marginalized residents. Consequently, CEI also advances positive peace. Now, while neither SFL nor CEI is perfect, and there are always new ways they may increase their support of marginalized people, both of these environmental organizations have used their land-based initiatives to be of great service to their communities. Now for the differences. Perhaps the most important difference between these cases are the socioeconomic and cultural context of the municipalities in question. As I mentioned in episode 1, Columbia, Maryland and Cape Town, South Africa were founded upon directly opposing purposes. The planned city of Columbia was intended for integration on the basis of race, class, and religion. In contrast, Cape Town was built upon separation through colonialism, enslavement, and apartheid. Consequently, the manner in which both organizations respond to their respective communities' needs is strongly influenced by the legacies of these founding intentions. For instance, while CEI does have an outward-facing gardener training program called Nourishing Gardens, the majority of CEI's environmental and educational services are centered at Freetown Farm and the Green Pharmacy Garden. The majority of staff, volunteers, and interns are connected to the organization's work through these two properties, and the produce that's grown and donated to community partners comes from Freetown Farm. In other words, most of CEI's impact is rooted in its service of people directly on the land that the organization stewards. In contrast, the core of Soil for Life's offerings involve outward-facing training efforts. The Home Food Gardening and Basic Health Program is SFL's flagship community offering. It involves trainers going out into different townships and neighborhoods to form hyper-local networks of home gardeners. Similarly, their community gardening projects involve trainers going into Cape Town's many sub-communities and providing technical and material assistance.
Food insecurity is much more pronounced in Cape Town than Colombia, so it made sense to me that an organization like SFL would emphasize its efforts on outward-facing work. Yet, for both CEI and SFL, their impact is grounded in their land-based initiatives, especially gardening and farming.
I see what you did there.
Thanks. Secondly, the flagship programs of SFL and CEI experienced different levels of initial success. This influenced their respective developments as nonprofit organizations. In the case of Soil for Life, Pat Featherstone's work initially focused on setting up community food gardens in the Cape Flats. But despite the gardens being a good first start for addressing food insecurity in that part of Cape Town, the model of community gardens proved ineffective. This inspired the pivot to home food gardens, which not only drastically improved retention of garden participants, it also led to SFL diversifying their course offerings to include health education. From 2009 to 2020, SFL successfully trained 6,048 people from low-income areas to become home food gardeners. SFL's overarching vision remained the same, but the delivery of that vision through its core programs had to shift early on to accommodate people's actual behavior. In contrast, CEI's early evolution as an organization responded to the success of the Columbia Families in Nature, or CFIN, program. CFIN began as a nature club in 2014 as part of the doctoral research of Dr. Kiara Diamore, and invited families in Howard County, Maryland outdoors for events like hikes, camping trips, gardening, and local species identification. From 2014 to 2017, CFIN grew from hosting 30 events in a year to 52 events. Also, it saw participation grow from 457 families to 586 families. CFIN's very positive reception from the community served as a strong foundation for CEI's expansion of programs and services.
You know, that pivot Soil for Life made early on is a great reminder about the importance of trial and error.
I agree. It also goes to show that the best community-serving organizations are sensitive to the needs and behaviors of those they serve.
I'm glad y'all caught on to that. I think that's something both SFL and CEI have done excellently throughout the years, is meeting people where they are, which takes us to our research takeaways. I've always been partial to research that has practical applications. So here are some recommendations for action that different kinds of people can apply based on what we've learned in this series. Firstly, for community-serving nonprofits, stay sensitive to the needs, behaviors, and input of the people you serve. For 10 years and 22 years respectively, both CEI and SFL have thrived as environmental nonprofit organizations. Central to their thriving is them being flexible in their program offerings and organizational structure. In the face of low retention rates for community gardens, SFL pivoted to home gardens. In the face of the COVID-19 pandemic severely disrupting typical food access, CEI emphasized growing as much food as possible at Freetown Farm. If you lead or work within a nonprofit organization, I invite you to think seriously and strategically about how responsive your organization is to your community. If you aren't already, consider the following questions on a regular basis.
How do we meet our community members where they are? What specific methods of communication and interaction matter the most to the people we serve?
Which of our programs, services, or resources do our constituents seem to ask for most frequently? How can we sustainably increase or at least maintain those offerings?
Which of our offerings looked good on paper but don't seem to be reaching people as we intended? Why not? What barriers to access are folks facing? What can we change about our approach to best serve people?
Answering these questions is essential to the longevity of your organization. Secondly, for policymakers, invest in and protect land for community well-being. As I hope was clear from this series, gardens, farms, and other land-based initiatives are proven spaces for people to find common ground, develop tangible skills, protect the environment, and advance their health. City and county-level governments are especially well-positioned to protect land for gardening or farming through zoning laws and more thoughtful consideration of the sale of public land to real estate developers. For example, CEI's purchase of Freetown Farm in 2019, which at the time was called Shaw Farm, the last operating farm in Colombia, was supported by the Howard County government and has protected the land from development. be careful not to become part of something sociologists call the urban growth machine. On first listen, urban growth machine sounds positive.
Hold up. You're advising political leaders to not be part of an urban growth machine?
Isn't growth, especially economic growth, a good thing?
In the right context, absolutely. But economic growth shouldn't come at the expense of the lives, land, or jobs of longtime local residents. This term, urban growth machine, describes a coalition of local political leaders, business owners, and developers that, among other things, seek to increase the financial value of land for the sake of eventual sale, rather than protecting the use value of that land for local residents. In other words, this machine treats land as a commodity, rather than a living, teaching, and loving part of the community. If you're serious about protecting the well-being of your constituents long-term, then you have to be serious about protecting community land. A powerful example of a local government protecting community land comes from the 1997 Protect Our Parks Initiative in Seattle, Washington. According to sociologist Charlotte Glennie, the Seattle City Council passed a law in 1997 that, quote, prevents the city of Seattle from redirecting any of its land used for parks purposes without first holding a public hearing and furnishing an equal or better replacement lot for the same purposes in the same neighborhood. This effectively, quote, prevents the city from selling any of its parks, community gardens, or other recreational spaces.
Really? Who would have thought a local government in the United States would ever pass a law like that?
I definitely didn't.
Don't get it twisted. This law came after consistent lobbying efforts and pressure from a local coalition of neighborhood associations, open space advocates, and the public, led by garden advocates from the local community gardening nonprofit Pea Patch. Which leads me to my third recommendation, and this one's for you, the listener. Take action and invite others to join you. Remember that protecting the earth begins with you. Consider organizing your community into a club, interest group, business, or nonprofit organization around a given cause. The founders of the Community Ecology Institute and Soil for Life saw that the people in their respective cities could benefit from certain land-based initiatives, and they took initiative to address problems for people around them. You can do the very same thing for the planet, other people, and for any number of other causes. In both cases I studied, I noticed collaboration and collective action everywhere. At Soil for Life, garden trainers collaborated with local residents to identify neighbors who would be interested in also receiving training. This set the foundation for neighbors with home gardens being able to help each other by exchanging seedlings, fresh vegetables, gardening tools, and wisdom. At the Community Ecology Institute, staff members, volunteers, interns, and other visitors are always working together. From plant care to building fences and sheds to fundraising and art projects, people come together with their unique skills and passions to make great things happen. No matter the cause, collaboration is key. But especially for making improvements to our environment and in our social world, you have to work with others. As my favorite African proverb says,
if you want to go fast, go alone.
If you want to go far, go together.
As you may have noticed throughout this series, I've presented quite a positive view of gardens, farms, land-based initiatives, and the organizations that are connected to those initiatives. That point of view is influenced by my personal experience working within such an organization, the review of academic literature, interviews, and analysis of other people's stories as gardeners. However, that doesn't mean home gardens or community farms are the end-all be-all. Nor is my perspective as a vocal supporter of land-based initiatives perfectly unbiased. So while I've touched on some of the challenges facing CEI and SFL and the communities they serve, I know I could stand to more deeply discuss the shortcomings of things like small-scale or urban agriculture.
I appreciate the honesty. You know, this is as good a time as any to enlighten us on some of the shortcomings.
Okay, true. Well, for one thing, no matter the size, type, or age of a given garden or farm, cultivators need access to land. Whether we're talking about the home gardens of women in Cape Town townships like Langa or Guguletu, or CEI's community farms in Howard County, reliable access to some amount of land is required. As a result, not having consistent access to land, be it a backyard, front porch, or community garden, hinders individuals and groups from reaping the multitude of benefits that comes from gardening and farming. One study I read regarding urban agriculture in Cape Town highlighted the challenges facing urban farmers that lacked land tenure or the right to own, rent, cultivate, or otherwise use land, which itself includes natural resources like water, soil, and physical space. As the study noted, quote, production practices are short-term and characterized by constant searching for new land when the current land tenure ends or is violated. As such, urban farmers are never in a single place long enough to form relations with each other and possibly establish a functional urban farmer group. This affects not only group gardeners, but home gardeners who are tenants on the property, end quote.
So, in other words, if members in a given community don't have consistent land access in the first place, they can't sustainably participate in gardening or farming?
Exactly. And all those benefits of land-based initiatives, like building healthy human relationships, developing practical skills, and adopting environmentally friendly behaviors, never manifest?
Right again.
Another limitation I hadn't touched on much in earlier episodes relates to participation. Outside of very determined individual gardeners who tend plants at home, agriculture involves multiple people, often lots of people. In relatively ideal circumstances, where financial resources are abundant and community members are currently or are inclined to become socially engaged, land-based initiatives can thrive. Just look at the success of the Community Ecology Institute and Soil for Life. But, as another researcher in Cape Town noted, community gardening projects in particular are strongly influenced by rates of attrition. Lots of people may join a community gardening project or agree to be in a network of neighborhood home gardeners, but for a variety of reasons, like a change in interest, inability to invest time, or competing familial responsibilities, groups of cultivators may slowly shrink or dissipate. The unfortunate result is wasted resources or less than ideal program outcomes, like less produce being grown or less overall income. Even with those limitations in mind, I still find gardens, farms, and similar land-based initiatives to be an essential good for communities, even when accounting for the variability in the types and designs of community gardens. Researchers have observed community gardens facilitate social cohesion between people, whether or not they garden for social or agricultural reasons. Also, meta-analysis of gardening studies has confirmed statistical evidence for a wide range of health benefits, including, quote, reductions in depression, anxiety, and body mass index, as well as increases in life satisfaction, quality of life, and sense of community, end quote. So, despite challenges related to land access and collective participation, the social and health benefits of gardening and small-scale farming are worth the investment. Another limitation to my findings are my own communication and potential confirmation biases. I had a much easier time pursuing and securing interviews for CEI than I did for SFL. That's because of my long-term relationship with the organization as a former intern and now volunteer on their board of directors. While I absolutely did my best to offer a balanced comparison of CEI and SFL, there are shortcomings to having such a close, pre-existing understanding of one organization compared to the other. Given my own time constraints, I struggled to pursue interviews for SFL with enough time to make my project realistic. Had I known that this thesis was going to be what it is and the direction I've taken in this final product, I definitely would have interviewed folks in Cape Town last summer when I was there.
Well, hindsight is 2020.
Facts. But despite these constraints, I still learned so much in this research process. I now know several ways I can build on what I've learned. For instance, in the future, I think it'd be a good idea to have more semi-structured interviews. In the case that I find myself comparing multiple organizations or groups again, I'd prefer to speak directly with folks from all organizations involved, rather than having to partially rely on secondary sources. Also, as much as I hope you all have enjoyed my voice and that of, quote, Mr. Left and Mr. Right, I think getting to directly hear the stories, lessons, and experiences of the folks I'm studying would be far more powerful for the audience. In any case, these are just my research findings up until this point, and this thesis is truly just the beginning. As I bring this episode to a close, there are some folks I want to express my gratitude to. First and foremost, I want to give thanks to Mother Earth. I am alive, healthy, and connected to the abundance of life through your lands, water, skies, plants, and animals. Thank you for giving me everyone I know and for being my forever home. I pray I can protect you better. Next, I want to give my sincerest thanks to my thesis advisors over at Georgetown University. Dr. Elham Atashi, director of our Justice and Peace Studies program, Dr. Randall Amster, co-director of our Environmental Studies program, and Dr. Bernard Cook, director of our Interdisciplinary Studies program. Dr. Atashi and Dr. Amster, I cannot believe I had you two my freshman year in 2020 and 2021, taking your classes in the exact same room I'm recording this episode in. To think it's been 4 years since then. Your guidance has deeply changed my life for the better, and I was able to travel the world because of the both of you and your incredible insights and encouragement. Dr. Tashi, you have introduced me to ideas that fundamentally reshaped how I look at peace and war, justice, and the human experience. I'm a much more hopeful human because of you. Dr. Amster, you've been so instrumental in giving my passions for the environment and sustainability places to be expressed and refined. Thank you for always reminding me how everything is connected. And Dr. Cook, thank you for not only believing in my academic and creative vision, but giving me much-needed guidance on how to make this research project workable. I am sorry for the headaches I am sure I've caused over the years. I want to give a very special thank you to my dear friend, Sofia Monsalvo, who created the beautiful series cover art for Peace of Earth. I'm so grateful for your generosity and spirit, and I'm continually in awe of your many skills. I also want to give a shout out to my brilliant classmate, Elizabeth Saunders, my fellow interdisciplinary class of 2024 graduate who conducted eye-opening research on technology for sustainability and social impact. Please check the show notes for her thesis. Thank you so much to my many professors throughout my 4 years at Georgetown, whose classes and wisdom made me a better scholar and human. I especially want to shout out Dr. Sabrina Wesley-Niro and Dr. April Sizemore-Barber, who led my classmates and I through the life-changing experience of studying in Cape Town, South Africa in the summer of 2023. Also, my deepest gratitude goes to everyone at the Community Ecology Institute and Soil for Life. You're all doing such important, timely work. Listeners, if you're still listening after all this rambling, I humbly ask that you check out these organizations online or in person for yourself. You will not regret it. Lastly, to Pat Featherstone, I pray you are resting peacefully. May your memory, teachings, and passion continue to nourish people for generations. And with that, this 4-episode podcast miniseries has come to an end.
Oh man.
But don't worry, you can always reach me to ask questions, bounce ideas, offer critiques, or anything else really. My email, which you can also find in the show notes, is alc332@georgetown.edu. I know we talked about a whole lot of information, stories, and people in this episode, and that might be overwhelming for you. Just know that you are not alone in your pursuit of a better, healthier, and more sustainable world. Because of that, I invite you to get outside, to get into a community, and to get to work in whatever way excites you or helps you feel connected. Maybe that means volunteering at your nearest community garden or calling up some friends to start a garden of your own. Maybe that means researching organizations in your city or county that are working to provide food assistance to those in need. Whatever the case may be, try to take some action today. And please, feel free to let me know what you do. I'd love to hear from you. And who knows? This may not be the last you hear from this show. So, until next time, go outside, talk to someone new, and remember that the peace of Earth begins with you. See ya.